We have to look at this as an emergency, as a humanitarian disaster, deal with it like we've had a hurricane or an earthquake that says we're going to make exceptions to the rules to get people off the street. And I'm hoping that we can galvanize a movement to fight against that. If we don't address why people are on those streets, then we're just going to keep cycling back and forth.
Shane Murphy Goldsmith, President and CEO of Liberty Hill Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to a very special bonus episode of Conversations from the Front Lines. Recorded before a live audience at our annual Leadership Appreciation Brunch, we spoke to Mayor Karen Bass on the eve of her inauguration about her aspirations for a more just and equitable Los Angeles. In this special episode, we also go behind the scenes to tackle the future of youth, housing, and environmental justice in Los Angeles. How many of you knew Karen Bass when she was elected as chair of the Congressional Black Caucus in 2018? Raise your hands. And raise your hands if you knew her all the way back when she was elected as the first African-American woman speaker of the legislative body of this very state in 2008. Who knew her when she was on the Liberty Hill Board and the Liberty Hill Community Funding Board in the late 80s and early 90s? And who knew Karen Mayor Bass, in the late 80s when she founded the Community Coalition and got her very first grant from Liberty Hill?
Yeah.
And who knew her when she was in the Vincent Amos Brigades to Cuba? Wonderful. So we go way back with this amazing mayor, and there's just wild amount of love in this room for you, and I think we all feel like you're part of our family. That's what we're going to claim.
Yeah, I claim it too.
Been around since forever, and we're so happy to have you today.
Thank you. Celebrate this
day with you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
So I have 117 questions for you. And we are going to leave time for folks to answer questions as well, or ask questions. So first, how are you? You must be, exhausted, excited, daunted.
I'm doing fine. But I just have to say, walking into this room, that was, I don't even know how to describe it, except for the love that I felt in this room and that I have felt around the city has been wonderful and overwhelming at the same time, and makes me feel just so hopeful and determined that I know we can do this, Tori. I do. And Tori and her team. So many people played such an incredible role, and I just am very thankful for everything that everybody did. Thank you.
We would love to hear about the campaign, not all the stuff that we saw on the news, but just sort of the Karen Bass behind the campaign. So can you tell us a time on the campaign when something made you laugh, like really laugh?
Oh, that was kind of on a day. Rick made me laugh a lot. He did. It was like, come on, guy. The last time, though, was in the last debate. And it took every ounce of discipline out of me because my team was like, don't attack him, don't attack him. So in the last debate, when the moderator said, because it was after the tapes were released and all of that, and a moderator said, well, Angelenos have a choice to make, either an African-American woman or a white man. And he was like, I'm Italian. That's Latin. And I started to say, okay, Rick, now you're Latino. First you're a Democrat, then you're for choice, and now you're Latino. You're Rick Caruso.
Oh, I love it. And what about your family? How are they feeling? How are you bringing them on the journey?
That was really something to me. I was very surprised by my family. I have three brothers who I'm extremely close to, and then my children and grandchildren. And when the idea came up for me to run, and I think maybe some of you know, I wasn't jumping to do this. I had to really be persuaded. It was a little grassroots campaign. And I'll talk about why I ultimately made the decision. But when I first raised it with my family, I was shocked that they were surprised and supportive. And as a matter of fact, my daughter and son-in-law came to me. They came over one day and said, we think you need to run for mayor. And I was like, because other people were trying to tell me that as well, and they were not connected to that. So it was like totally disconnected. But I was really surprised by their interest in persuading me, but also just the support throughout the campaign. And then watching my daughter kind of rise to the occasion and start speaking and introducing me. And a lot of people didn't know about my stepchildren because I chose this life. I didn't think it's right. You don't put everybody into it because you choose this, but they chose it this time. And my two grandsons, my boys, just wanted to come with me all the time and campaign with me. They'd be on their iPads the whole time, but they wanted to hang out with me. And so that was been very nice.
It's beautiful. So tell us about that choice. Why did you decide to do it?
I was fine in Congress and love the issues I work on. And the hardest part about leaving was the foreign policy piece. And those of you that go back to the 70s that know I've always loved foreign policy. And the idea of being in Congress where I could work in Africa, and I was the highest ranking woman on the Foreign Affairs Committee, chairing the Africa Committee. I went to Africa all the time.
Wow.
And the idea of leaving, that was tough. Over all the years, I mean, back when I started Community Coalition 32 years ago, and we were watching the homeless situation start, and we were trying to take over motels in the 90s because we thought we could deal with two problems. We could deal because the motels, you know, we had 54 motels in South LA and no tourists. So you know what was happening in the motels. So we thought we could deal with multiple problems at the same time. And, you know, over the years, people have always congratulated me and given me a lot of accolades for accomplishments. But I've always had this gnawing feeling in me that, yeah, okay, I mean, I'm happy with what we've been able to do, but I wasn't able to get the people off the street. I wasn't able to. And that always gnawed at me. And then I didn't realize that I had all this goodwill citywide. I mean, I knew that people knew me in my district. That's where I've been. But when I was going through the VP consideration, I was in D.C. So I had no idea that raised my name ID citywide. And folks know Jeffrey Katzenberg was one of the ones that was. Jeffrey Katzenberg and Matt Johnson were two people who were really trying to get me to do this. And so Jeffrey at one point got annoyed because I was being dismissive. The other thing is that, you know, I also thought Mark Ridley Thomas was going to run, and I was not going to run against Mark. So Jeffrey did a poll. And when the poll came back, my name ID and my favorabilities was way off the chart. I was like, oh, shit. It was like, I didn't even want to look at the poll right away. It took me. But then I felt like, well, okay, it's great. I got this goodwill. What difference does it make? What purpose does it serve if I don't do something with it? And then, you know, the idea that, you know, it was going to ultimately wind up being Rick and people feeling like I could take him on and that the others, you know, weren't going to be able to. And interesting, the poll numbers for the other candidates stayed the same, actually, all the way through. Then I said, I have to do this. It was tough. You know, it was a tough decision to make. But once we got past the primary, and the first 6 months was really tough, you know, with 30 debates, hundreds of interviews, that was a real slog. But once we got past the primary, then it was like, this is a righteous fight. And then it was fun. What I wanted to do all along was to build the type of movement campaign, a coalition, bring everybody together. You know, we had a youth component, Youth for Bass, and, you know, a real vibrant group of young people, teenagers and college students that I plan to continue to stay involved with. So after June hit, then we could build the kind of campaign I wanted to have. And then I felt like, you know, again, it was a righteous fight. It was just very clear between the billionaire or the activist, which one? And then the lifelong Republican. And I mean, I don't know how Rick is looking at it, but when they suggested that he become a Democrat, that was dumb. That was really dumb. Because if he had run as an independent, it would have been harder. It's like, okay, you're a Democrat? And you know. So my objective right after the primary was to suck up all the Democratic space. Suck it all up so that there was no way he could say he was a Democrat. He could no support at all. So we had the Democratic Party right away and then sought all of the, you know, the endorsements from everybody so that he had no room to say that he was a Democrat. But I'm sure he was told that you can just say this and then you'll drown her. Hey, Isaac, our assemblyman. Oh, right. that he could just drown me in ads, which, you know, he attempted to do. But interestingly, the ads, what they did, I knew everything they were going to do because it was all the stuff that was done when I was under VP consideration. Mm. Same consulting.
As you know, one of the things that got some folks worried during the campaign was the seeing how well Crusoe was doing in Latino communities and a worry that maybe you weren't doing as well. Can you share kind of your choices and your reflections on that?
I mean, that's right, because he had all the money. The difference was, though, and, you know, because we all know each other, people think like you just like, OK, I'm African-American, so I don't know Latinos. It was kind of funny because I think when he was campaigning, he was kind of like a tourist. It was like he was like, ooh. I'm going If he said the Downtown Women's Center one more time, I was like, Rick, did you go anyplace else? But, you know, these are communities I know. And so the fun part of the campaign was as I went to East L.A. and the Valley and all, I was reconnecting with folks that I'd known for decades. So we had broad support in the Latino community. All the Latino elected officials, with one exception, Gil, supported me. As a matter of fact, he was so funny when the tapes came out. He said he attacked me. It's like the tapes come out, he attacks me. And he said that everybody in that room endorsed me. He forgot Gil was in the room. So then he had to retract that one pretty quickly. I knew he would outspend me. Now, we also knew, by the way, back last year, that his whole campaign strategy was going to be a black-brown strategy, was going to try to pit our communities against each other. We knew that. And so, because the thing about him is that there's a lot of people that work for him because he pays a lot. I'll leave it at that. So we knew certain things. And so knowing that he was going to do a black-brown strategy, you know, I was talking to people right away saying, you know, if it turns out the way we think, which is me and him, I know you've endorsed Kevin, whatever, which is fine. I mean, I didn't have a problem with that. But, you know, we got to come together after the primary because this is what he's going to do. So we asserted a picture of unity immediately. And we'll see how when the vote analysis is finished. But I was able to contend for the Latino vote. And that's all I needed to do. His theory of winning was he was going to turn out people who don't vote. Well, you know, that's a strategy that all of us use. But we understand that you can't just turn people out on a one-off. Mm-hmm. It's building relationships with people to expand the electorate, to change the electorate. That's our strategy. But we've never viewed it as I'm just going to pay you $35 an hour and you're going to get those people who don't vote to all of a sudden vote for me. It doesn't work that way. So it was a flawed, in my opinion, a flawed strategy. But, you know, California Calls and all of the groups that do the grassroots work, that's the basis of the work, right? But California Calls and all the organizations that with California Calls have been doing this expanding and changing the electorate and building a relationship in between elections for years.
And so what are your reflections on the election outcomes aside from your amazing victory? What do you think about what was won here in Los Angeles and nationally?
Well, nationally is another story. But I think here, you know, I mean, I'm just really inspired that people, I mean, because it was tough. I mean, $108 million to my nine. $9 million, and then if you add in the independent efforts, it might have been another six. But I was just very inspired that people didn't buy it. I think what the analysis will show is that my vote spread across geographic areas, across race, across gender. Because, you know, the theory in June, and this was so annoying because the pundits right after, you know, on June 8th or whenever the election was, they were saying, aha, L.A. goes conservative. And boy, how did that turn out? It was exactly, you know, Carnicky or whatever, you know, from MSNBC. It's like, so we were calling him up like, no, dude, you got to change this. Because 2 days later, it was a totally, you know, different picture. And so I think it just showed that L.A. was not ready to take a conservative turn. And that was the other thing, by the way, that I forgot to mention that because it was one of the most important parts of my decision. Is that, you know, when you've been around long enough, you can predict what's going to happen. And it was so obvious what was going to happen. We were getting ready to repeat the 90s. in 1990 when I started Community Coalition, you know, because we didn't call it mass incarceration, but we saw it taking place. And the whole reason why the coalition was started was to stop that. But we didn't have any power, any positioning, any standing. Liberty Hill gave me, what was it, Paula? It might have been it.
$4,000.
Yeah.
The best $4,000 we ever spent.
And, you know, and I mean, and Paula knew and Michelle knew. I had no clue what I was doing. None. I just was afraid that we were going to start locking everybody up. And so here we are with 40,000 people on the street. And there's a sentiment in this town of like, we're sick of this. We taxed ourselves twice. It got worse. Can you just get rid of these people? Mm-hmm. That sets the stage for another round of incarceration. And given the extreme disproportionate numbers, that was the thing, was that I felt then if I didn't do it, then, I mean, how could I turn my back when I knew what the outcome was going to be? But now, 32 years later, I'm in a whole different position. And one thing I'll say now, and I think we'll probably get into a little later, is that our movement has progressed and developed and is sophisticated enough to win elections. But where we have a lot of work to do is once people get elected, we don't know what to do with them.
So what do we do with them?
Well, you know, I deeply believe that the only way we're going to deal with this issue that we have, there has to be a movement that helps. And I actually think there needs to be a faith component to the movement because there needs to be a moral issue. And we need to raise the sentiment in the city where people would be embarrassed and ashamed to say, not in my neighborhood. I mean, you know, you go build it, but just don't build them near me. And we have to get people involved to actually fight against the barriers that keep people unhoused. And I worry, and I, you know, some people might be upset at me for saying this, but I worry that the state of things right now, people fight against folks being moved, but I don't feel they fight for people to actually be housed. And I say that because they're very specific barriers. I mean, like one, for example, that you have to have an ID in order to get a voucher. I have a voucher for you, but I'm not going to give it to you until you have an ID. But you've been in a tent for 5 years. So how are you supposed to have an ID? But I'm going to help you get an ID. Where's it going to be mailed to? Can I give you this voucher? And then you'll have an address that you could actually get an ID? So it's things like that, barriers, and I'm trying to deal with this on the federal level as well, to say that we have to look at this as an emergency, as a humanitarian disaster, deal with it like we've had a hurricane or an earthquake that says we're going to make exceptions to the rules to get people off the street. And I'm hoping that we can galvanize a movement to fight against that. I mean, there's the Cecil Hotel downtown that's pretty much empty. There's General Hospital that is empty. There's St. Vincent Hospital that is empty. We need mental health and substance abuse. If we don't address why people are on those streets, then we're just going to keep cycling back and forth. And 15 members of the council, a mayor, and 5 supervisors cannot do that alone. We have to wage that fight in our neighborhoods. And so that's what I hope to do, is to really help. Obviously, the movement is on the outside, but I want to do everything I can to try to facilitate that. Like after the tapes came out, or at least I heard about them. I think most of us heard about them on a Sunday. So on a Tuesday, we had a meeting and brought together civic leaders. And it was kind of interesting because when we went around the room and introduced ourselves, every category that was on that tape was in the room. And so to me, I viewed that as an opportunity. Okay, so some bad stuff was exposed. I reject strongly the notion that that set especially Black-Brown relationships back a decade. I reject that because, first of all, we've spent decades building relationships. How on earth is a tape and 4 individuals going to erase all of the work and relationships we've built? And we have to strongly assert that. And then what we did was, we asked the people that were in the room, Representative Gomez and I, to facilitate a series of dialogues around the city. But part of those dialogues will be, you know, dialogues are important, but it's about action. But I think some of the action that should take place is the redistricting commission, that's obvious. Expanding city council, but let's do it in a thoughtful way, not a knee-jerk way. But also, isn't this an opportunity to look at structural inequity in the city? Because that was really what that was about. That's what they were conspiring about. And so can we address some of those issues and take that negative and turn it into a positive? And so hopefully we can keep intact. Because, you know, the thing about campaigns is like after election day, it's kind of like a amputation. I mean, you got all this adrenaline, it just shut off, you know? So today from here, I'm going to a volunteer appreciation event. But I hope to keep people involved so that we can build this movement that says we have to house LA, but we have to specifically go after the barriers that need to be. We need to force the different levels of government to relax those barriers.
Yes. Speaking of which, you may know that when Jenny was with us, we created Stay Housed LA, which is now the largest eviction prevention program in the country, in the city and county. Our community partners reached out to over 1 million tenants in the last couple of years to address the things that were pushing renters into homelessness.
Prevention.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so what folks may not know, and I'm obsessed with these statistics, so there's something called inflow, very important.
Right.
So this is inflow of people into homelessness. So in 2019, with the homeless count, there were 59,000 people homeless. And in that year, 23,000 of them were housed through the homeless system. Another 53,000 went into housing. So that's 76,000. The year starts with 59,000. 76,000 people are housed. And with all the money we're spending and with numbers like that, how is homelessness increasing every year? It's inflow.
Right.
So in the same year when we got 76,000 people into housing, 66,000 new people became homeless in a single year. So it's just constantly, you know, shoveling the water out of the leaky boat.
Which is why it has to be a comprehensive approach. You've got to prevent people from falling into homelessness. And, you know, I would do this but before the campaign, when the propositions passed. You know, I would, because the average person felt like one, city council stole the money. I mean, nothing happened. Nothing was built. No one was housed. No one's doing anything. That's what you have to fight against when you have neighborhood meetings. And I would tell people, actually, we are housing people. But for every 200 folks, 215 more fall into homelessness. So what my plan is I want to have a 100-day strategy that identifies some of the most challenging encampments and get those people housed, because that's what people have to see. They have to see something different. And if they can't see something different from me in 100 days, my goose is cooked. I'm really clear about that. But I want to use it also as an opportunity to educate people, because people also believe that the person in that tent wants to be there, is a meth addict. And again, it's because people get so demoralized. You know what I mean? And I know on the campaign trail, I spent countless times describing the diversity of why people were there. And you have to have multiple strategies. It's not just one strategy. You can't have the same strategy for somebody who is profoundly mentally ill and a teenager who aged out of foster care. Those are two entirely different. Or the woman that's fleeing domestic violence. I always talk about the thousands of children in the tents to humanize people. But I think it's an opportunity to educate people along the way. And I do think that elected officials, and I would include myself in that, have been lacking in terms of communicating what actually has happened. I mean, maybe I could do a COVID style. You remember, I mean, not every day, but, you know, to have a press thing that with a map and a chart and, you know, a panel of people who were formerly unhoused to talk about their situation. We have to do all of that. But also we have to get people mainstreamed because, okay, you're in permanent supportive housing. You can't be there your whole life, but you have to deal with jobs and other barriers otherwise. But I think we tend to think of it as shelter, interim, permanent, but we don't think about what comes after permanent. Mm-hmm. For some people, we are going to have to take care of them for the rest of their lives. That's true. But that's a small percentage. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about your goose is cooked if you don't show a big difference in 100 days. I mean, that's absurd, though. But I mean, that's what scares me about addressing homelessness is we have elected officials who, these are structural problems. There's wages, there's mental health care, there's tenant protections, all these things that no elected official can address if they're up against some 100-day media timeline. How are you supposed to make real progress on these very entrenched issues if you're held to this insane standard?
I better figure it out. How about this one? How about the election was declared Wednesday and I have to set up an administration in 3 weeks? How about that one?
Jenny can handle it.
I know. I know. Sorry, Liberty Hill. Sorry.
Yeah, we'll talk about that later. So, of course, your long history started, as you said, in fighting against mass incarceration and criminalization of folks, especially Black men and lots of people of color in Los Angeles. And here you are running for mayor and partly on this platform, and then you get severely criticized by your good friends at Black Lives Matter for that approach. And you and I have this in common. And when I hit bottom when I was on the police commission and I just didn't know what to do anymore, I called to Karen, and Mayor Bass was generous enough to kind of talk me through how to navigate in an environment where we have authority over the police department. We're trying to transform the system from the inside out, but that's not in alignment with the abolitionist vision that so many of our friends and allies and partners have. So I'm curious, you know, both kind of how you just personally deal with people who you're close to disagreeing with you in that way, but also they were pissed at you because you wanted to increase the size of the police budget and increase the number of police officers on the streets. So what's your vision around that, and how do you sort of reconcile that with your friends?
Well, I actually didn't say increase the police budget. We have to hire police officers because of attrition, which they're already budgeted for. And I also said, as I went around the city, it's very clear in some neighborhoods they want to see an increased police presence. And in some neighborhoods, they don't. The neighborhoods they don't tend to be the neighborhoods that I have focused on, which is South LA. And so I think that we have to deal with crime, and I'm just going to say it, but we got to figure it out. It's really hard to talk to somebody who just was assaulted or just was robbed and talk about the structural reasons why what happened to them happened. I have devoted the last 32 years to dealing with criminal justice reform and looking at ways to prevent crime. But we have to come to grips that when crime happens, we have to deal with it happening. And I worry that when we do not do that, we then concede that space to the right. Because then the right says you do not have an answer. And the answer is law and order. That's what I worry about. I don't want to concede that space. I want to contend for that space. I'm not naive about this. I'm going to get criticized for a lot of things from everywhere. From every side.
Not from us.
But I have to, I have to keep my eyes on the prize. The other thing is that it's not always bad to be criticized. In other words, you know, you want that pull from the other side also. I experienced that when I was speaker and I had to make terrible cuts to all of the stuff we fight for. I had to cut education and healthcare. I had to raise tuition at the universities. And the students protested me. They actually held me hostage one time. It was kind of funny. My staff was freaking out. I'm like, I'm fine. This was me 20 years ago. We're fine. Anyway, what I did when they were holding me, is I said, and I talked to them, I said, so these were my options. These are the choices I had to make. And sometimes you have to do things that are not popular. So one of the things that I want to do is set up an Office of Community Safety that does not involve law enforcement. Mm. I want to double, triple, and quadruple down on prevention and intervention.
Yes.
All of the strategies that we know work. I find that those areas are never invested in a consistent way. We dabble. We give the interventionists a little bit of money. And then we kind of let them fend for themselves. Now, I've always stayed in touch with the interventionists. You guys know what I'm talking about? I met with them when I was thinking about running, and they asked something of me, and it just broke my heart. They said, would you commit to making sure that we're paid at least $40,000 a year?
Oh, my God.
And I said, no. Nobody can survive off of $40,000 a year. You need to be paid at least $60,000. I said, and we need to figure out how to deal with your trauma. that you go mm-hmm. through on a daily mm-hmm. basis doing your job. So the 10 years I was in Congress, we couldn't do earmarks. Of course, we get them right when I'm leaving, right? So the earmarks I've done in my districts are earmarks to fund the interventionists. And then Tony Cardenas and I are doing joint earmarks this year so that we can really raise a lot of money for the interventionists. So I want to really, really, really beef up that side. I want to look at grid and all of that. And I think it needs to be refocused on. But at the same time, if a robbery happens, a robbery happens. Mm-hmm.
So you talked about the role that folks like us and the amazing community organizers that we support play in sort of building this movement to really put pressure on your office and the city and the rest of the Angelenos to move in the right direction. So I'm curious, what advice do you have for Liberty Hill? And really, like, what's your power analysis of Liberty Hill? Where do you think what's our sort of role in this? What influence might we have? And how might we continue to build and wield the influence of this sort of ecosystem of community organizations toward this vision that we all share?
Well, I have to admit, I've been away for a while, so I don't know exactly where Liberty Hill, but knowing where Liberty Hill's always been, which is playing a convening role, which has always been extremely helpful. But the social justice organizations that you fund, I guess what I would ask is that if somebody somewhere, because I know I'm not trying to say that people aren't doing the work to get people housed, but please, I'm not trying to say that at all. But there are very specific barriers that need to be relaxed. And I think we should demand that the barriers be relaxed, like, you know, the identification, like a 42-page application. I mean, some of the bureaucracy is based on a non-emergency situation. Mm. It's based on 10 or 20 people being unhoused, not 40,000. Mm-hmm. And so I think on the city level, there are barriers, the county, the state, and the federal level, there's barriers. But I don't see people up in arms saying, why do I have to have an ID? Or if you're a veteran, you know, why do I have to have an honorable discharge? And maybe you don't have to have an honorable discharge, but maybe you had a dishonorable discharge because you had a joint in Georgia. I mean, you know, did you commit treason? I mean, if you didn't commit treason, then why would you not house a veteran? And I was over at the VA. You remember when everybody was on San Vicente? So I was at the VA with the VA secretary. And when we were there, they told us, just as calm as anything, that they had like 200 to 300 vacancies. And we were like, what do you mean you got 200 to 300 vacancies? Why are there all these tents out there? Well, we're trying to get them certified. And it's like, can't you like put them in an apartment and do the certification? So some of the absurdity of that, that's what I don't see. And if it exists and I'm just not aware, please tell me. Because Liberty Hill, I would think, might fund a study or something like that. I mean, I don't even think it needs to be a study. It just needs to be collecting data that already exists. Mm-hmm. What are the barriers? I can certainly, you know, give you some. But what are the barriers that we could rally around? And then also the neighborhood organizing in areas that are going to be resistant. I know when the propositions first passed, I have represented West L.A. for a long time, including Century City and Cheviot Hills and those areas that said, basically, if the proposition passes and you dare to think about building here, we're coming after you. So what I did was we organized our constituents that were active. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to create a critical mass of residents who would not oppose. And so we put them through an education process. We brought in scholars. We brought in people who were formerly unhoused. We took them to Skid Row. We took them to the Hall of Administration, so that if something was going to be built in their area, they would be a force to say, this is okay. And one of the things that's kind of funny in some of the affluent areas is that they actually already have these programs and affordable housing, and they don't even know it's there. It's the notion, you know what I mean? And so the thing is that you saw the articles in the Times about how the inner city, some of the inner city areas are some of the most overcrowded areas in the country. So the notion of some people in the more affluent areas is, I support affordable housing over there. But if the areas are already severely overcrowded, the only way we're going to solve this is for housing to be built everywhere. And so to the extent that Liberty Hill could participate in that, but it's outside of the inner city. I always talk about Sherman Oaks. Sherman Oaks is bitterly opposed to SB 9. They don't want people building on their single family homes. But what I liked about Sherman Oaks is that they were proposing an alternative. And their alternative is the commercial areas where the outdoor shopping malls are underperforming. So if there could be neighborhood organizing in the more affluent areas that begins to create this political will, and then also the moral standard of this is LA's problem. This is not just a problem in South LA, East LA, and mid-city, central city.
Mm-hmm. All right, this is my last question. So you've been doing this work for 50 years. Mm-hmm. What are your reflections on where we've been and where we're going in terms of the issues closest to your heart?
One of the things, again, that pulled me into the race is full circle, is that if we're not careful, and one thing that's nice about being around so long is that you do remember. And I do think culturally Americans are pretty ahistorical. You function in the moment and don't think about what happened 10 years ago and how it might inform you. And so I feel like we do circles. Hmm. And that we have to bring along the next generation to be historical, to look at what has happened in the past. And especially with social media and Twitter, and I don't want to say dummying down, but everything is so, it's not a book anymore. It's, you know, 20 characters or whatever. And that's my news. And I think that that's really important. So the significance of the practical significance of history is something that I think is really important.
Thank you so much, Mayor Bass. Thank you so much. That was amazing. Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us for season one of Conversations from the Front Lines. We are so excited to announce that a second season is officially on the way. Stay tuned for season two in the new year, and be sure to join us for new episodes and exciting new guests as we explore the themes of power, politics, and solidarity in LA. In the meantime, revisit all of season one episodes here or on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to give us a like and share your favorite episodes with your friends. We'll see you soon for more Conversations from the Front Lines.